I want you to think a little bit more generally about the idea of measurement that we've been using. And you'll have noticed, some of you have pointed out, in fact, several times, there's a little bit of a tension between the way the textbooks, especially the older textbooks, frame quantum theory, in which measurements are associated with projections, and we have a postulate to deal with that, and the idea that measurement devices, whatever they are ultimately themselves quantum systems, and there's a unitary, we can treat them as interacting unitarily with the quantum system that we're actually interested in measuring. So I want to explore that tension a little bit more. I want to think more generally about what happens when we have a system that's under our control and a second system, and now a second system that is definitely interacting with the first one. So we've played about quite a lot with composite systems where S1 and S2 are isolated. And we developed quite a simple but quite powerful technology involving reduced density matrices for analyzing separately the behavior of S1 and S2 in the situation where we were, whether there is no interaction between them, or in the situation where we're ignorant of the outcomes of any measurements on the other system. And that's, has turned out, of course, to be a very fruitful line to explore. It leads us to understand the delicate, peaceful coexistence between quantum theory and special relativity, the fact that there is no way of sending signals to S1 by any action at all on S2. But it's by no means the full picture. We're often doing experiments on a system that is, at least to a large extent, under our control, but isn't completely under our control. It's interacting with stuff in the environment. Photons and cosmic rays are being scattered from it. And we still want to be able to say what we can about the physics of such systems. So I have really in mind here two different cases, which mathematically are going to be the same, but are going to have slightly different physical motivations. In one of them, S1 is our quantum system. And S2 is some sort of experimental apparatus, something we're going to we might think of as a measuring device. And we're trying to understand the physics of what happens when we bring S1 and S2 into interaction. There's no point in having an apparatus to measure S1 unless there's actually some interaction between them. So they're definitely not going to be isolated in that context. And the second possibility, S1 is still a quantum system. S2 is what we're going to call the environment, which could, in principle, really mean everything except S1, the whole of the rest of the world. Or it could mean some selected part of the rest of the world that is particularly relevant because its interactions are dominating. So, for instance, S1 could be a small quantum computing circuit. S2 could be the thermal background in which it's operating. So the photons that are interacting with our quantum system despite our best attempts to protect it. So we're going to explore this because it leads in various interesting directions. But I want to sort of stress ahead of time that I'm not claiming that what I'm going to present to you is a resolution of all the problems of quantum theory. In particular, I'm not claiming that it's a resolution of what's often called the measurement problem, sometimes the reality problem, sometimes the problem of deriving classical physics from quantum physics, or the problem of explaining why, if the world is fundamentally quantum, it nonetheless appears approximately classical to us, quasi-classical to us on the large scale. We will touch on those questions, but they will, to my mind at least, remain live questions after the end of our discussion. So let me start from a quite old way of modeling measurements that really goes back to von Neumann. We're in this picture, this first picture here, system one, and S1 is quantum system, S2 is the apparatus. And I'm going to write down what's obviously a slightly idealized model, but an illuminating one. So we suppose the apparatus is designed to measure some observable, maybe the energy. But anyway, some Hermitian operator M of our quantum system S. We have the eigenstates of M, and we're going to idealize by assuming that the system itself is doing nothing if it's left alone. There's no system-self interaction. And the same is true of the apparatus. There's no Hamiltonian associated with the apparatus. So this is, I could have just written zero here, but I'm stressing we would generally expect some apparatus self-interaction, some general H here, and that H is zero. Likewise for the system. So those two terms are irrelevant. The only thing that's going to be relevant is, in this model, is the interaction Hamiltonian. And it's going to take a very special form. It's going to be a sum of product operators where the first elements of the product are projectors onto these eigenstates, the eigenstates of the observable we're trying to measure. And the second terms are going to be, for the moment, let's just say they're sum operators on the apparatus Hilbert space, but we're actually going to say more about those, restrict those also in a minute. So what happens if we do that? Well, we're trying to remember to model the measurement of an observable. So we want to start with the system in a general state. Here are the eigenstates of the observable, so we can take a general linear combination of those. We're going to assume the apparatus is in some pure state. So at the start of this process, the system and the apparatus are not entangled. We start with the product state, like so. We apply the interaction Hamiltonian for some finite time t, and we're going to assume there is some finite duration to this interaction, and then it effectively switches off. So we're interested not really in a continuing process of observation, but a one-off measurement interaction, which brings us from here to here, where each of these terms here, the MM tensor AM, has the effect of producing an evolution-like operator, e to the minus I MT over H bar on phi zero. So that the state M that started out tensored with phi zero now becomes tensored with phi m of t in the superposition. So we evolve from here, product state, to here, and now entangled state, you'll notice. This is a sum of product states, but it's not itself a product state, assuming the phi m's are different. Okay, now I said we were going to restrict the form of the m. For the moment, let's assume that this is a perfect measurement, and this measuring device does a perfect job in the sense that if the system is in state M to start with, so it's actually in an eigenstate of the observable, we know for sure that there's a readout somewhere on the apparatus with a dial that could point to lots of different values. Here's M, here's M prime, here's M double prime, and so on. But whenever the system's in state M, after this interaction, the pointer on the apparatus will actually point to the answer M. So we could call, in that situation, this state, phi M of T, this state here, the pointer state associated with the number M, the readout M. And actually, this terminology gets generalized. So even if we don't have a perfect measuring device, even if we have a measuring device that doesn't have pointers, even in the end, if we have some interaction between a system and something else that may be nothing like a measurement device, we often call these things, as long as this model is applying, we call these things pointer states. So then the question, I guess, becomes how well they play the role of the classic, the idealized pointer state. Okay, so what happens in this model? We start out in the product state, we move to the entangled state. If we look at the system, focus on the system and its reduced density matrix at time zero. It starts out as rho s of zero. Well, we need to trace over the apparatus, but it's just in a pure state. So we really just get the density matrix associated with this initial state of the system, which is just that ket times the corresponding Hermitian conjugate, the corresponding bra. And of course, there's a single sum here, so I need a double sum for to give both the ket and the bra. And I could simplify that, tracing out the apparatus bit, to this. So that's the final form of the reduced density matrix. That's the initial form of the reduced density matrix of the system. What happens after the interaction? Well, now we have to take the reduced density matrix corresponding to rho s of t, this thing on the right. And now the calculation is slightly less trivial because we have factors corresponding to the amplitudes for the different pointer states, phi m prime and phi m. Okay, but if these are really, although quantum descriptions of a device which actually has a pointer pointing to a definite point m on the dial, then the states corresponding to the pointer at m and the states corresponding to the pointer at m prime have to be orthogonal states. They're perfectly discriminable. We can tell whether the pointer's at m or m prime. So we have this relation, phi m prime, phi m. The amplitude is zero unless m equals m prime. And so this simplifies to, sorry, there's a typo there. Actually simplifies to a single sum once we allow for the delta function. Let me just erase that. Yeah, please. The point, well, as long as they're, if you like, we could think of this just abstractly as a assumption of the model for the moment. We're going to assume that everything. But the underlying intuition is, as long as there's a classical object that's actually pointing at m or m prime, the states are orthogonal. Okay, then I think what you might be pressing at is, if this is a continuous observable, then even if we're talking about classical objects, if m and m prime get close enough, there must be some slight uncertainty in the position of the pointer, and so these things. Let's just take it to be a discrete observable for the moment. Maybe that's the simplest thing to do. Yeah. I'm sorry. Which?
In the first.
In this slide.
Yeah.
So what we're really using there I need to flip back the slide. Okay, so the Hamiltonian is this form. We're interested in the evolution operator using minus IHT of rho h bar. So the question is, what does that do to m by zero t? Yep. What does it do? Well, you'll notice that we have projectors onto the different eigen states here. So all but one of these terms is irrelevant. The only one that's relevant is corresponding to m. So that's going to be the same as e to the minus I t over h bar m tensor a m acting on m tensor phi 0 t. And, well, this is a projector onto this state N. In other words, that equivalent to the action is trivial. So it's only this that gives us something not trivial.
Okay.
Are you happy with that, Phil?
Yeah. But why is the Hamiltonian can be written like this?
Oh, why is it in this form?
Yeah.
In general, of course, it wouldn't be, but we're trying to... Our intuition is that we've got some classical device that actually does do good measurements. So if the system is in eigenstate, the pointer actually will move to the point out. So we're trying to write down a model that has that feature. And if we assume, and this model does have that feature, if we assume that this is the form of the Hamiltonian, and we assume that the pointer states are orthogonal, so we assume this thing red at the bottom down here, then we do indeed get that m phi 0 goes to m phi m of t with certainty, where this is a quantum state that describes your measurement device in which the point is actually pointed to the outcome. So I'm not claiming that this is a perfect model of any realistic measurement, but it's a reasonable idealization of the measurement process if we're trying to capture what sort of quantum interaction could give the right properties for a measuring device.
Okay.
So the reduced density matrix changes, you might have. We start with a double sum. We end up with a single sum. We start with
quite non-trivial, off-diagonal terms involving m and m prime for m prime different. Same typo, sorry. And we end up with a single sum and only diagonal terms in the density matrix in this particular basis, the basis of the observables we're supposed to be measuring. So if we're just focusing on what happens to the reduced density matrix of the system, we could sort of summarize it as saying the interaction with the apparatus has killed all its off-diagonal terms. That's basically what's happened. So let's suppose for the moment that this is a reasonable model. What we've created is an improper mixed state. We actually have an entangled state of the system and the apparatus. We're tracing over the apparatus degrees of freedom to define the reduced density matrix. But it's an improper mixed state. On the other hand, physically, if we go through this interaction and then carry out experiments only on S, we can't actually tell the difference by any sequence of experiments between that improper mixed state and the proper mixed state that we get if we listed the probabilities mod cm squared for each of the states m. If you take that list of probabilities and states, write it as a mixture, well, there's the probability, and there's the corresponding ket and bra for each of the states. So there's a subtlety here that we need to be careful about. So I'm choosing my words with caution. But mathematically, the density matrix that we actually derived, the improper one, has the same form as the one we would have derived if we'd gone a different route. If we'd assumed the projection postulate held for this interaction, we assumed that we were carrying out this particular projective measurement, that the probabilities of the outcomes were given by mod cm squared, and we assume that we don't know the actual outcome, so we're ignorant of the actual outcome, then we end up with this beast. Okay, so I have two slides. What does this explain and what doesn't this explain? Let's start with what it does, or at least what I claim it does. It explains why
if we do experiments on the system after this interaction with the apparatus, and I'm going to assume now that this is an irreversible interaction and the apparatus is going to go away, it's not going to be relevant again. So at any time after the interaction, it explains why we get outcomes in those experiments that are consistent with applying the projection postulate. In other words, with describing the state of the system as a proper mixture. So let's take a concrete example. What do I mean by that? Suppose we first go through this interaction that has the effect of producing this reduced density matrix, and then carry out a measurement of, so to speak, looking for cross-term interference, a measurement of this projector operator onto 1 over root 2 m plus m prime for different m and m prime. Well, we just need to work out what's the probability of getting the eigenvalue 1 for this projection. It's given by the trace of projection times the reduced density matrix. There's the projection. There's the reduced density matrix, which is a single sum. And so you see all the cross terms vanish, because if m prime is not equal to m, then it's going to have inner product 0 with either this ket or this bra or both. We only have terms where m double prime equals m double prime in the ket and bra here. So we just get the terms coming from the diagonal elements of the density matrix, mod cm squared, mod cm prime squared, and a sort of normalization factor at half. We see nothing involving cm and cm prime. And that's true after the interaction. It's true after this measurement process. But it wasn't true before. If we started at time 0 and asked what's the probability of getting eigenvalue 1 from this projection, well, we need to now look at the reduced density matrix before the interaction, and that's a double sum. And we get cm squared and cm prime squared, indeed, as we have here. But we also get cross terms from this double sum. If I take the inner product of m with m double prime, well, that's non-zero of m double prime equals m. If I take the inner product of m prime with m triple prime, that's also non-zero of m triple prime equals m prime. And those, I can satisfy both of those somewhere in this double sum. So we end up with an interference term that's this thing plus its complex conjugate, twice the real part of this product. So the interaction with the apparatus has removed the possibility of picking up interference in between the different components of this, between the different eigenstates of this observable. So as I said, we also need to think about what this doesn't explain, or at the very least doesn't evidently explain. What it doesn't explain is that we don't see a reduced density matrix. What we actually see is one definite measurement result. The pointer actually points to one place, m, and we know afterwards that we're in the eigenstate m. So we get extra data from the system, the outcome of the measurement, that wasn't described in this calculation of the reduced density matrix. And we still, if we want to set out a mathematical rule that allows us to derive that why we get that data, we still need to apply the projection postulate or something equivalent to the projection postulate to conclude that. We haven't derived the projection postulate itself from our little discussion of this toy interaction. The distinction between the proper and improper density matrices is crucial here. The reduced density matrix we calculated was improper. We can't just snap our fingers and say it's really a proper density matrix. We can treat it as a proper mixture. We can assume that it's a probabilistic mixture, and moreover, that we're aware of the outcome of the random selection among that mixture. Okay, so we explained something. We didn't explain everything. That's life. But it's intriguing as far as it goes. We obtained some important physics. We understand why we lost interference. We understand why the system reduced density matrix takes a particularly special form purely by looking at the unitary evolution of S and A. So that, with armed with that insight in this toy model, I guess our next project is to see how much further we can push that insight. Okay. So far we've been looking at a very special version of this model in which these terms were zero, this was a projector, and these also create orthogonal pointer states. These states are orthogonal for M and M prime unequal. Suppose we're going to stick with some idealization because there's no point in complicating things unnecessarily. So we're going to leave this term as zero, and we're going to leave this term as zero. But suppose we relax our assumptions on the form of the interaction Hamiltonian. And just suppose we have an interaction over some time that is given by some unitary evolution operator. And let's leave it at that now. So system interacts with apparatus for some time. That's characterized by a unitary U, then the interaction's over. What can we say in that case? Well, I still want to assume that the apparatus, for the moment at least, that the apparatus looks like a measurement apparatus in the sense that it looks like something that's capable of measuring something. So it has a dial, it has a pointer, it has output readings on the pointer. But I'm no longer assuming that it's a perfect measurement apparatus. I'm no longer assuming that if we start with the system in eigenstate M, we actually will get with certainty the pointer reading M. Maybe it's maldesigned. Maybe it's just more complicated in one way or another. You could think of it as a nearly perfect apparatus with some tolerance for errors, or we can just accept that maybe it's even quite far away from our ideal of perfection. Let's just write down U and see what we can do with it. On the assumption that we still do have pointer states we're able to talk about, even if they're not created by the interaction. Okay, so I want to spell out that this unitary U is what's causing the system and apparatus to interact. So we have, there's no nationalism intended here. USA as the evolution operator between S and A. We still assume that there is a pointer, so there is an interesting set of orthogonal states of the apparatus. Let's call them K now. So that's the interaction. What happens after the evolution? Well, we're now in a final state which is just given by the trace of the ket times the bra, where now we have this general unitary evolution USA. And I can write that in a suggestive form if I make use of the fact that these pointer states are available to me. So I'm going to assume that they're orthogonal, and in fact, I also want to assume they define a complete basis for the apparatus. Let me stress that, I think. And let these form a complete basis. For the apparatus Hilbert space. Okay, so I can introduce a decomposition of the identity into that complete basis. So I'm using here identity is on the apparatus is the sum over K, K, K. I can put that inside the trace and then calculate the trace explicitly by our usual trick of pulling this around and writing out explicitly amplitudes. And you see that it breaks up into a sum of two partial inner products. So let's look at those. Well, this one's basically just the conjugate of this one. So let's look at this one. What is this here? We've got a U acting on the joint Hilbert space, HS tensor HA. So that this is a state in HS tensor HA, inner producted with K, which is a state in HA. So we have not a number, but a state. We have a state sitting in a state of S, a state in HS. You notice that it's a linear function of the initial state psi zero. So we can think of this thing as the action of some operator. We could write this more compactly. A sum operator, AK, acting on psi zero. And I've written it, I want to stress that this thing depends on K, so I've given it an explicit label K. But let's notice that I'm suppressing some other dependencies here. It depends on K, but it also depends, of course, on U. And it depends on the initial operator state phi zero. Okay. So these things turn out to be important. We're going to give them a name, Krauss operators. And here we have the same expression again. This is the final reduced density matrix of the system. This is what we called AK psi zero. So there it is. This is just the Hermitian conjugate, psi zero AK dagger. And you see, of course, the initial density matrix of the system was just psi zero. It was this thing without the AKs. So I could rewrite this as sum over K, AK acting on that initial density matrix, AK dagger. What do we have here? Well, we have what actually looks rather like a generalized form of our previous evolution laws for density matrices. Rho S initial has gone after this interaction to this expression, sum over K, AK rho S, AK dagger. I have to come clean, I only derived this for a pure initial density matrix. On the other hand, everything in this calculation is linear in the input. So if I take some convex combination of these things, some linear mixture of these density matrices, it will still go through. It's linear in the input, it's linear in the output. So this evolution law actually holds, given our assumptions, for any density matrix. Pure or mixed. What else can we derive from this? Well, we know the reduced density matrix of the system has to be normalized. Obviously, that's true for the initial one by assumption. But for the final one, that gives us a non-trivial condition. Identity is the trace of rho S final. So that's the same thing as the evolved form of rho S initial using the Krauss operators AK and AK dagger. And I could pull the AK dagger around in each of these terms. So this is this, and I can, by the way, pull the sum inside a bracket, I guess. So this is the same as the trace of the sum over K, AK dagger AK times rho S initial. That has to be one. It has to be one for any initial density matrix, pure or mixed. Actually, for this little bit of the argument, it would be enough for it to be pure. So the only way that can work, given that rho S initial itself has to be normalized, is for this sum to be the identity. So we have a non-trivial constraint on these linear operators. The sum of the AK daggers times the AKs has to be the identity. That should be reminiscent of what the completeness condition for projection operators. It's analogous to it. We're going to call that the completeness equation for these Krauss operators. Okay. So now we have this idea that whatever the actual form of the interaction between S and A, we have an evolution law. Rho S goes to sum of KAK, rho S AK dagger. We define the AKs, remember, in terms of the pointer states K. So now let's go back to our previous sort of way of thinking about measurements. You've got a classical apparatus. You've got a pointer. It's going to point somewhere. You can look at the pointer, and you can see where it's pointing. And if we do that, we pull out some particular value of K. What are we doing in terms of the mathematics of quantum mechanics? We're carrying out, after this evolution, we're carrying out a measurement of we're carrying out a measurement of the apparatus defined by the projections onto the various possible pointer states. So we start with the S plus A starting in state psi 0 S phi 0 A. We have our USA final state. And now we apply projective measurement defined by the projections onto the different orthogonal pointer states, KK, for the apparatus. We're taking a step back from where one normally starts when thinking about measurement. You normally think of the apparatus as measuring the system, but now we're thinking of the system and the apparatus as both quantum systems. They interact, they end up in some entangled state, and now it's us looking at the apparatus is the point where we're going to apply the projection postulate and declare that a measurement is taking place. So if we do that, we'll get one answer. We'll see the pointer in one place. We'll get one answer, K. And what's the probability of getting answer K? Well, it's just given by the contribution of the projection associated to K to this reduced state. So it's just given by this expression, trace of AK psi 0 AK dagger, which we could write more compactly in terms of the reduced density matrix. And what's the state of the reduced density matrix after that measurement? What's the state of the system after that measurement? It's AK psi 0 S, or in density matrix terms, that ket times the corresponding bra normalized. And again, we can write that more compactly in terms of the reduced density matrix in this symmetric form, AK rho S, AK dagger, divided by a normalization. It's just trace of that. So it's, what is this normalized? Obviously it is. If I take the trace, I just get trace over trace. So this is just recapitulating what was on the previous slide. I just want to notice that this is as it should be, but given the way we set the discussion up, this is a generalization of the familiar case in which the AKs are just projection operators, PK. And then the completeness condition, some AK dagger, AK equals the identity, becomes some PK dagger, PK is the identity. But the P's are Hermitian and their projections. So this PK dagger is PK and PK squared is PK. So this is just some of the projections as the identity, the familiar completeness condition. And the probability of outcome K is just given, instead of AK dagger, I have PK. Instead of AK, I have PK. And again, because it's a projection, I can simplify this. PK squared is PK. So I get the familiar probability rule and the post-measurement state, again in the familiar form. Okay, so what have we learned from this? We've learned that there's a more general way of extracting information from quantum systems than the one described in the older standard textbooks. If you take the system, interact it with something that you can get a number out of, something with a pointer, but don't assume anything more specific about the form of that interaction, you can find a generalization of the standard measurement postulate. And that's what we have. That's what we have here. Is that a legitimate way of getting information from a system? Clearly it is. You take it, you interact it with something else, you look at the something else. Well, that may or may not be giving you useful information. It depends how you set things up. But you're clearly inferring implicit information about the quantum system from that process of bringing it together with something else, letting them evolve so that the state of the second thing, the apparatus, is affected by the system, and then looking at the apparatus after it's been affected. Okay, so once one decides that one can generalize the projection postulates, it's a natural question is how far can you go? We started with a simple toy model, and then we extended it. It would be natural to push further and see if we can find more general models still with further generalizations of the projection postulate. It turns out, actually, though, that the last model we looked at is already enough. We obtain the Krauss operators from this specific construction with this specific model with USA. But one could show two things. And the first is, any time you've got a set of operators satisfying this condition, you can find a way of implementing that measurement. Whether it's practical or not, one would have to look further into. But mathematically, you could find a unitary operator U and some apparatus of appropriate, some Hilbert space that represents an apparatus of appropriate size, with the property that if you implement the model we just described with that U and that apparatus, you end up with your set of operators, whatever it was. So we could find an apparatus space HA, we could find a unitary evolution U, an initial state of the apparatus phi zero, and some orthonormal basis, let's call it the pointer basis, just to keep the same language, of HA, with the property that the operators we've decided we're interested in, the AKs, fall out of this model using the rule that we use to define the Krauss operators. So for any set of Krauss operators satisfying the completeness condition, we can find, in principle at least, some way of implementing the corresponding generalized measurement. Okay, so all measurements of this form, in principle, are implementable. I'm not going to give you a foolproof of that, but I'll give you a little sketch. Suppose you've given me a set of operators satisfying the completeness condition. One way of finding an apparatus Hilbert space and a unitary interaction that realizes the measurement defined by these operators is to take the Hilbert space to have a dimension that's is equal to the number of these operators plus one extra one. And I'm going to just say, okay, so let's call the extra set zero, and let's take a labeled orthonormal basis one through to k, one basis element for each of the AKs. What's the unitary operator going to do if I start with the system in initial state psi zero, and the apparatus in this special state, this extra state zero, I'm going to define it. I'm going to say, I will find a unitary operator u that evolves this particular initial product state into this sum, the sum ak psi 0 times pointer basis k. So initial product state evolves to this particular entangled state. And I'm going to find, I claim that I can find a u that will do this for any psi 0, any choice of the initial state of the system. Do you believe that? Well, you should test it. Let's at least notice that it's a consistent definition. If I look at the mod squared of the left-hand side and the mod squared of the right-hand side, mod squared of the left-hand side has to equal 1. The mod squared of the right-hand side is guaranteed to equal 1 because of the completeness condition. It just involves psi 0. And this operator, which we know is the identity, the sum of the ak daggers, aks. Okay, so how to finish off this argument? Well, you need to check that this is a consistent way of defining u that works not just on states of this form, but extends to the full tensor product Hilbert space, HS tensor HA. And that actually turns out to be pretty easy to do. You've defined u for some subspace, which is actually the space of any state in S tensored with this particular state, 0 in A. All you need to do now is to say that if you've got any state orthogonal to that, it gets mapped to something orthogonal to all the states on the right-hand side, and you have a one-to-one way of taking some partial basis of these states and mapping them to a partial basis of these states. And it doesn't really matter. For the purpose of this construction, it's not going to matter exactly how you do that. It's not particularly hard to see that this could be done. There's a good discussion of this, for instance. It takes about a page in total in Nielsen and Chuang's lecture notes. And if people would like, I could circulate a proof afterwards. But let's just accept that this sketch can be filled out into a complete proof. So, what's the implication there? If we start out in product state, we apply this particular u, we produce this entangled state, we measure in the pointer basis, and indeed we're now measuring the k basis. So we get outcome k. The system state afterwards up to normalization is this term in the entangled sum. Okay. So, we have, at least I've tried to persuade you that we have, a generalized evolution law for at least a one-shot evolution from time 0 to time t for rho s, the reduced density matrix of the system. Rho s goes to this sum. If we think, you think about a trick that we've played a few times now. You find something sitting in quantum theory, and then you try and think abstractly about its properties, and then ask what's the most general mathematical object that can have those properties. So we did that with density matrices themselves. We wrote down a concrete definition of density matrix. Rho is some Pn, psi n. And then we noticed that rho is self-adjoint. And it's necessarily normalized if this is a genuine probabilistic ensemble. And it's necessarily positive semi-definite. So we noticed that all density matrices have those three properties. And then, with just a tiny little bit more thought in that case, we noticed that the converse was also true. If you've got an operator on Hilbert space that has those three properties, it is necessarily a density matrix. So let's try that strategy again here. We've got an evolution law that takes one density matrix to another one.
what physical and mathematical demands can and should we make on any such evolution law? Let's just call it E. E for evolution, or E for effect, the effect that it has on rho. So rho goes to E of rho. It's got to be linear, as this one is. It's got to be the case that if we flip a, if somebody else flips a coin and gives us either one density matrix or another, but doesn't tell us which, and then we apply the evolution, it's the mixture stays unchanged. Otherwise, we've got a way of extracting more information than quantum mechanics allows. So take P rho S1, 1 minus P rho S2. That's got to evolve to the same probabilistic mixture as evolving, how to say this, P rho S1 plus 1 minus P rho S2 evolves in this to be that same mixture applied to the individual density matrices, rho S1 and rho S2. It's got to give us a density matrix. This thing has got to be normalized in particular. So it's got to be trace preserving. Trace of E of rho has still got to equal 1, given that trace of rho was. And again, if this thing's a density matrix, then it's got to be, it's got, E of rho has got to be positive semi-definite. So E has got to be a positive operator. It's got to make positive semi-definite operators as output whenever it gets one as an input. We get a physical density matrix in, we've got to get a physical density matrix out. And then one extra little subtlety. This evolution could be could apply to any system we're interested in. And that system itself could be entangled with other stuff. So we could have S prime as inputs. And the evolution, let's assume, affects only S. So we start with rho S, we end up with E of rho S. But it must be the case that S prime, that's just being left alone, together with S, is still in a valid physical state after the evolution. So E tends to the identity, acting on the joint state of S and S prime, must be a density matrix. And that turns out actually to be a slightly stronger condition than the positivity one. It's called completely positive. So we certainly need that to hold as well. And that's a list of four properties, and that's all I want to extract from what, there's the only obvious constraints on a evolution law E. So it turns out, not going to prove it, but it's very, very well worth noting. It turns out there's a wonderful theorem, which we've already touched on, the Steinspring dilation theorem, that says given any such evolution, given any such E, there is some set of Krauss operators that implements it. There's some set of AKs satisfying the completion condition, such that what is E of rho? It is just this particular evolution, some AK rho, AK dagger. And so, well, we've already noticed, if once we've got the AKs, we could find some apparatus A with its suitable Hilbert space, a suitable sized Hilbert space HA, some initial state of the apparatus, and some unitary interacting between S and A, such that E of rho is just given by tracing over A of that evolution. Given the AKs, we can find a unitary on a larger combined system, S plus A, that reduces to that evolution on the smaller system. So to answer the question I raised a few minutes ago, we don't need to go any further in looking for more generalized models. This is as general as it gets. Whatever our system apparatus interaction,
does, it's got to produce some evolution. That's a physical evolution on the system itself. It's got to satisfy those four constraints. And then Steinspring tells us there has to be a set of Krauss operators corresponding to that. And we already have a model that gives any possible set, every set of Krauss operators. So we have a generalized definition of what it could be to be a measurement, and we see it's as general as we can actually get. Are there any questions there?
It's a bit of a trek through mathematics, and you probably want to read through it again afterwards and make sure you got clear the statements. Okay, if people are comfortable, let's move a little bit further.
As I promised, we could talk about system apparatus evolutions, but we can also talk about system environment evolutions. And in fact, our discussion's really taken us in that direction already. We ended up looking at a completely general interaction, USA. We didn't assume anything about the property of U itself. And so, at least as far as that part of the discussion is concerned, we might as well have been talking about our quantum system interacting with anything at all. Cosmic rays, photons, whatever is relevant, whatever's actually perturbing the thing. Clearly, that's something we actually need to do. Our laboratory systems are never completely isolated, and they're often quite far from isolated. We need to understand the effects of the environment. In quantum computing, it's really the key technological problem to implementing quantum computers. Analyzing in environmental effects and dealing with them, trying to protect against them. It's also not, it's a more than practical interest, it's also a fundamental interest. We'd like to understand, we'd like to get as much insight as we can about quantum theory. The environment seems like a significant factor, at least. Maybe it sheds some light on the deep problems of quantum theory. Certainly we need to understand to what extent it can and cannot shed light on those problems. So again, I want to play the same trick of looking at toy models and seeing what we can glean from toy models. There are lots of different models you could look at. I've just taken a couple here. So in this first one is a model of, it's a crude model. I hold my hands up. But a quantum system in some initial state, like so, in some sort of heat path, some thermal mixture of photons, let's say, in a mixed state, 1 over n phi k phi k. And the idea is that this interaction, these things interact, so that the nth state of the system pushes the nth state of the environment, it scatters the photons, so to speak, into the n plus nth state. And there's a cyclicity here, so we have a finite dimensional environment space, dimension n, and you should interpret this number modulo capital N. So, for instance, 1 interacting with capital N would give 1 phi n plus 1, but that's just the same as phi 1. What does that do to the joint system? Well, we're going to start in a tensor product state, like so. We're going to end up in a shifted state. And if we look at the reduced density matrix of the system after this interaction, you see again, because when I trace over the environment, I get a delta and m term, that we again get this diagonalization. We started out with all the cross terms, with the possibility of interference between n and m prime. We end up with a density matrix, the diagonal. In this particular basis, what was special about this basis? Well, the interaction picked out this basis, the interaction has a simple form in this basis. So we don't really have a pointer state here. If you actually look at the environment, there's no way of looking at the environment and finding a state that's correlated with system N after the interaction. There's no measurement you can carry out on the environment that would collapse this state further. But nonetheless, the reduced density matrix of the system has been diagonalized by this interaction. And there's another rather nice toy model that Wojciech Zurek devised. So now we wanted just a two-dimensional system. You could think of these as spin half particles, and an environment that's another collection of spin half particles, 1, 2, 3, all the way around to n. So I want to pick out the system as a thing we're particularly interested in. I'm going to give its basis states double arrows, double arrow up, double arrow down, and the environment single arrows, and with a label, k, which runs from 1 to n. Again, the self-interaction isn't really going to give us any extra insights, so we're going to neglect it. And now we're also going to neglect the possibility that each of these environment spin particles can interact with the other. So the only interactions are along these red lines from environment states to system. And we're going to assume a rather simple coupling of the spin of the system to any of the environment spins, which is just given by h bar, just to simplify the mathematics, sigma zs, so the z-axis is going to be picked out as special by this interaction, some coupling constant that maybe depends on the environment, which environment spin we're talking about, and sigma z for that thing, and identities for the others, and summed over each of these. So we have one sigma z tensor sigma z interaction for SE1, one for SE2, one for SE3, and so on, just all summed together. Okay. And I'm going to assume again that we start out in a product state of all n plus 1 particles. So here's the system. Here are the n environment states. Actually, one more comment on that. And I'm not going to make any special assumption about which particular state each of the environment spins start out in. So they can vary. There are coefficients alpha k, beta k, which depend on k. Okay, what happens if you apply that Hamiltonian for time t? You start out in the product state. You end up in, well, the system is two-dimensional, so any state at all I can write as some combination of up times some state that represents all of the environment plus down times some other state. And it's clear as well that these coefficients are going to remain unchanged by linearity. And if you go through the calculation, we can get explicit expressions for E double up, E double down, which just depend on these coupling constants and on these coefficients. So we're really just applying E to the minus I, GK sigma Z, T. And so we get E to the minus I, GK T for the sigma Z up eigenstate. And the same thing, but with the other sign for the down. So if you look at the system reduced density matrix here, where we need to take that ket and the bra, trace over the environment, it's got diagonal entries, mod a squared up, up, plus mod b squared down, down, and then cross terms that depend on the overlap between this state and this state, which we can calculate explicitly from these expressions. So we're obviously going to get an A B star term for one inner product and the complex conjugate of that. It's the rest of the factor, the things that depend on the alpha k's and the gk's and the t's that are interesting here. So let's call that z of t. That's just the overlap of those things. And it'll take you about 5 minutes, I think, to verify z of t, there's a k missing there. Z of t is just a product of terms, one for each of the environment states, that depends on these coefficients, 1 alpha k squared, 1 beta squared, and exponentials in gk, well, 2 gk t now, because we've got two terms multiplied together. And the modulus, what's the modulus squared of that? Well, it's, we have mod alpha squared plus mod beta squared is 1. We get basically sine terms from these two things. And it works out as this expression. And the key thing here is that this term for typical time t is going to be smaller than 1 and positive. This term for typical alpha k and beta k is going to be negative. We've got a minus 1 here. And if we it can only be non-negative if alpha k is 1 and beta k is 0, or alpha k is 0 and beta k is 1. Very, very special case. Otherwise, it's going to be negative. What do we expect on average if there's nothing special about these things? We expect, for a typical term here, that mod alpha squared is roughly the same as mod beta k squared. And so this term in the brackets here is 0. And if you take sine squared, and average it over time, the average value is 1/2. So as a first sort of crude guess, we've got a product of lots of these things which depend on k. They vary, but as a first crude guess, we can replace that product by the typical alpha k beta k, so this term's 0. Time average sine squared, so this thing's 1/2. So we get 1 plus 0 minus 1 times 1/2, 1 minus 1/2, 1/2. So we get a factor of 1/2 for each of the n terms, and a total expression for mod zk of squared of 1/2 to the n. Let me just, yeah. I've spelled that out a little bit more on this slide here. So we can use the time average value of sine squared to give us 1/2. We have 1/2 to the n times this expression. It doesn't really matter, actually, whether I set this to 0 or not, but that seems a natural thing to do. All that actually matters is that it should be smaller than 1, which is clearly true for generic choices of alpha k and beta k. So I think it's worth trekking through the algebra just because it's a simple interaction, but it's one that actually is exactly calculable. You can calculate every expression in this exactly. And what emerges from this at the end? These, remember, parameterize the off-diagonal terms. So we see once again that the reduced density matrix for the system becomes, for large values of n, becomes almost perfectly diagonal. The off-diagonal terms get killed. The diagonal terms are left unchanged. So
we're seeing over and over again in these models, the von Neumann measurement model and the last two models of system environment interactions that I've just given you, the same sort of phenomenon. If you have an interaction which picks out one basis as of the system as physically natural, you tend to find that then the system density matrix starts out in a general form with non-trivial interference terms, and tends to become diagonal in the relevant basis. And these are toy models, but if you look at more realistic models of mesoscopic systems, so dust grains, big molecules, anything of that sort of scale, or upwards, you find the same sort of phenomenon, and you find it for the physically natural basis, which turns out to be the center of mass position basis for most mesoscopic systems in typical environments. And there's a whole book, and a very thoughtful, very beautiful book with carefully dovetailed contributions by six different authors that I mentioned at the start of the course, Jos and collaborators, which gives very detailed and careful analyses of these sort of interactions. We're not going to go through those now, of course, but let me just quote some figures from Jos's chapter, or one of Jos's chapters in that book. If you look at the density matrix for a dust particle, and you could take a pretty big one, 10 to the minus 3 centimeters, or a smaller one, 10 to the minus 5, or a large molecule, 10 to the minus 6 centimeters in scale, and you look at the overlap between state at position x and state at position x prime, the interference term between those two, and you assume it starts out in a macroscopic superposition, a superposition in which there's a significant component in which the central mass is at x, and then also a significant component which is central mass at x prime. And you ask, how quickly are those terms suppressed? How quickly does it behave as though it's just a mixture of those two? Well, you find that this happens exponentially quickly, exponential in time, exponential, in fact, in the square of the separation of those positions, with some physical parameter that you have to model. You have to model the process in order to estimate. And the values of those parameters are just spectacularly large. This localization for anything that's anywhere close to macroscopic is astonishingly fast. So they quote figures for various things. And even the cosmic microwave background, which you would think of as almost irrelevant to any behavior of laboratory systems, collapses reasonably large dust particles very, very quickly, destroys macroscopic superpositions. Photons at room temperature collapses all of these things very, very fast. Sunlight on Earth, air molecules even faster. If you have air molecules at one atmosphere, you know, the coherence rate is almost literally astronomical. And even a laboratory vacuum with just 10 to 6 particles per cm cubed gives spectacularly fast rates of decoherence. So it's very, even if you have a way of creating dust particles in some sort of macroscopic superposition state with a non-trivial spread, it's very, very hard to sustain that state, to protect it against the interaction by the environment in such a way that you could think of doing some sort of interference experiment that would demonstrate interference between the component of the superposition here and the components of the superposition here.
Everything we can see at deep
pocket. What's left of the measurement problem?
Yeah, because you said we didn't solve it, so.
Let me. I mean,
it's fair that you, you're asking me, so I should give my answer. But let me give Yosef and Kiefer and Yosef and Zay's answer, all quoted from this. Sorry, several of them quoted from this book, and all of them quoted in the review article by Schlossenthal. We still have this problem that we've derived an improper. We described the description of the system as for an improper density matrix, and we haven't derived any way of saying that it's a proper density matrix. We derived something that looks like a probabilistic mixture. So this looks like a mixture given by the ensemble A squared, B squared probabilities, and up, down states. But nothing in our calculation told us that
one particular outcome, up or down, actually arose with one of these probabilities. We've just derived this object. We can understand if we do experiments on this thing now that we're not going to see interference between the cross terms from that follows from our calculation. But the appearance of a particular definite outcome doesn't follow from the calculation we've done so far. We still need the projection postulate in order to
That's my answer. I think that's fairly closely aligned with their answers. But I have a real duty here to stress, not for the first time, that we're touching on a point of controversy in quantum theory. You'll find very thoughtful theorists who work on decoherence, maybe Wojciech Zurek, one of the best known of them, who will give you the opposite answer, who will say that this does in fact result from measurement. With great respect to Wojciech and people on the other side of the fence, I just don't see that follows. I'm aligned with this view.
So
what's
their argument?
Still need to apply the projection postulate.
What's their argument? Why does this?
I try to be as intellectually empathetic as I can, but it's really hard sometimes to fairly represent a position that you just strongly disagree with. Let me refer you to Wojciech's review articles for that, rather than me trying to channel. People who believe it would put it so much better than I possibly could.
What was the article?
There are many of them. I'll put a bibliography on the bit. We're probably getting close to time, officially. Maybe even overrunning a little bit. Are there constraints? Is there another seminar?
They have a tutorial starting at 3.
You have a tutorial starting at 3? Yes? No?
Yes.
Let me just briefly touch a little further on this question of what we can and can't understand from decoherence. So this becomes it's already a problem when we're talking about doing laboratory experiments on quantum systems. It seems to be the measurement problem was already there. But it's maybe there in its most striking form if you think of quantum theory applied to the universe as a whole. And there are two possibilities there. Either you can't apply quantum theory to the universe as a whole, and then presumably there's something wrong with quantum theory. It has to be replaced by some deeper theory. Or you can. And most of mainstream modern physics implicitly or explicitly assumes the second, assumes that you can. But if you can, you've got this deep, possibly insolvable, certainly deep problem of how you end up being able to talk about measurements and the outcome of measurements if you're starting from an initial quantum state of the universe at the Big Bang, you apply unitary evolution throughout. When does measurement ever get into the game? However you try and attack it, how can you make sense of it? As John Bell says, did the world evolve happily for millions and billions of years until until life came along and started measuring it, and only then did the production option arise. We had to wait even longer until people with PhDs in theoretical physics came along. It seems like a profound conceptual problem, certainly from the perspective of people on one side of the argument. And there is, of course, a famous counter view, which was first set out, was created by Hugh Everett. And has slightly misleading to my mind, come to be sort of represented under the heading of the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory. I don't so much object to many worlds, or even the word interpretation as the, because there's a really proliferation of different views, incompatible views, that try and pick up on Everett's not entirely fleshed out ideas and make them rigorous. I think it's simply wrong to say there is one beast out there, one canonical thing called the many worlds interpretation. But anyway, Everett's aims and his claims were very clear. He didn't want to contradict Copenhagen quantum mechanics, but he wanted to go beyond it. He thought he had a way of thinking about quantum theory from which you could deduce the standard presentation and unitary evolution plus projection question. And he's very admirably explicit about that. In the standard way of thinking about things, you have one, what happens in measurements, discontinuous change. Two, what happens all the rest of the time, continuous unitary evolution. His claim was you could simply throw away one, retain two unchanged, and derive all of standard quantum mechanics, including the appearance of physics following the projection postulate, from pure unitary evolution. A theory based on pure wave mechanics, pure unitary evolution, is conceptually simple, causal, and gives predictions in accord with experience. Explain whatever it's been, explains the outcome of all the experiments we actually see. I think Everett was also admirably clear what that really entailed. When you do an experiment, and as you see in the models we've described, if you believe that pure unitary evolution holds throughout, you end up with a superposition of terms corresponding to different pointer readings. And if you apply the same sort of model to an observer looking at those, you end up with a superposition of terms that involves observers having observed different pointer readings. People ask, so which is the real one? Everett was very clear. They're all real. You interpret this superposition as a superposition of effectively independent worlds, each of which is actual, each of which is real. What happens after you do an experiment? There are many copies of you, each of which shares your memories up to the experiment, but each of which believes it's seen a different outcome after the experiment. I'm sorry, time is short, so I'm slightly compressing things. But, and he stressed again, in response to critics. Critics said, well, it doesn't feel to me as though I'm splitting into a gazillion different copies of myself each time I experiment. Everett says, no, well, it wouldn't. Just as it doesn't feel to you as though you're rotating around the sun at high speed, you need to look at the theory, look at the mathematics, see what it predicts your experience should be, and then you'll understand, in my case, as in Copernicus's, that the theoretical ideas do in fact predict what you do in that scene. I think I'm going to have to wrap up there to let you go to your tutorial. Just to summarise, there have been 50 plus years now of attempts by Everettians to elaborate Everett's ideas or present their own version, attempts by critics to highlight what they see as particularly thorny problems in Everett's ideas and reasons why his claims fail, and his theory is not consistent with experience. If you'd like to read more, there's a venerable but still very good, very readable volume of pro-Everettian ideas edited by Deutsch and Graham, Many Worlds Interpretive Recording Mechanics, and a much more recent one which has a mixture of modern Everettian and modern critical ideas, edited by Simon Saunders, and others of us. And you might like to, I can recommend some specific articles on both of those. Anyway, if you want to read further, those are good places to start. Quantum Fair Nations course will also be a good place to pursue these discussions. Okay, that's probably where I should start. Any questions?
In what way would I don't see how an idea like Many Worlds could be right or wrong. Like, I don't see how it has any, you know, it's like talking about things outside of the universe because you're talking about other universes.
Here I think is how it could fail. It could fail in that it turns out to be a genuinely weaker scientific idea than, say, standard Copenhagen. So Everett says you can derive the predictions of Copenhagen quantum theory, including all the things about probabilities, from Many Worlds. You could rigorously derive that if I do a sequence of experiments, I will get a distribution that agrees with the standard probabilistic rules. That could fail. Let's at least logically that could fail. So you better ask Everett for the details and see whether you agree with them or not.
But so
that's a point. That's definitely a point to which you could fail.
And this is the idea that the one path splits into many paths, but the path integral way of viewing quantum mechanics is that paths converge into present hit or the current history. So I would think it would have to go both ways, and then it would just be a way of phrasing path integrals. But that doesn't necessarily give reality to all the other paths. It's just a way of computing things or...
I think I tried to stress much earlier when we discussed path integrals. I think neither of these implies the other. They're both interesting ways of thinking about quantum theory. Everett at least was quite clear that he believed in the reality of these worlds. But you're touching, there's another point which I haven't touched on that you're pressing there. The simple problem of structure. How do you take a unitary evolving wave function and get the idea that this is split into effectively independent worlds that do not re-interfere, do behave independently. That's another problem which is much debated. And Everettians have different ways of trying to explain how they think that works, and critics have counter-arguments suggesting in their view that it may not or does not work. I'm sorry, maybe we should take this offline. I'm sorry, time is so short. But these are good questions, and still after 50 years, very controversial questions. Okay.
Thank you.